This is an interview with Jeffrey C. Bingham, who will be speaking with me, Rob Lynn, for the oral history collection conducted by the National Library of Australia. On behalf of the Director General of the National Library, Jeff, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this program.
Pleasure.
Do you understand that the library owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the form of consent?
Yes, I understand that now.
This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript of this recording should the library decide to make one?
Of course.
We hope you will speak as frankly as possible, knowing that neither the tapes nor any transcripts produced from them will be released without your authority. This interview is taking place today on Tuesday the 17th of May 2005 at Kingswood, South Australia. Jeff, can we begin, please, with talking about your parents.
All right.
Would you talk about who they were? That was Horace and Minnie Bingham.
Yes, well, Horace Bingham was, I think, about third generation. His folk came from Leeds in England. And so he was totally English in his background. And then my mother, who was... Her mother, and father were both Irish. One was Protestant, one was Roman Catholic. And so there would be the mingling of the English and Celt bloods with dire consequences in my case. But is there anything special you would like me to tell you about?
I'd like to tell me a bit about your mother and how your father came to win her.
Yes, well, that's very interesting, because she obviously was a very, well, by photographs, she was a very beautiful young woman, and her father didn't think very much of my father. My father was a dentist, and I think he wanted something a little more Irish, a less stiff and formal than my father, who was that kind of a man, but of course eventually they became very, very good friends. But yes, my grandfather was at one stage, I understand, president of Tattersall's Club, and that in those days was a pretty high ranking honour, unless of course you were Puritan in your approach to life, in which case it was very wicked.
So what was his name, Jeff?
His name was
was it
Dowling, D-A-W-L-I-N-G, Jerome Dowling. Yes, and he had a very interesting background. He left home at 15 from Ireland and Blackrock, and I think that's in County Cork, and he made his way to Australia and eventually became quite a rich man. And I can remember our family home. It was a beautiful place, and very, very large, because we had to look after it for a year whilst he went back to Ireland to get his second wife. My own grandmother had died in her early 50s, and he went back to get another wife who was his boyhood sweetheart and so on. But they're a very interesting family, and all my uncles and aunts, I had uncles who were, three uncles who were in the First World War, and I think two of them came back very much alcoholics, and horrible, interesting set of stories there.
Jeff, we have a need to backtrack a little now, which we're doing. Your uncles returned from the First World War,
yes,
and we were talking then about the way in which your mother, Minnie Dowling,
yeah,
the daughter of Jerome Dowling, was won by your father,
yeah,
Horace Bingham. Now, what do you know about their personalities that... you said earlier that they were very different people. Could you,
yes,
talk a bit about that again, Jeff, please?
Yes, well, my mother was a vivacious person. And she loved, I suppose, she certainly loved music and the arts, but she was actually used to play in J.C. Williamson's plays, and she was a very good at recitations, and she just loved music. She was a very good pianist, an excellent pianist, and she kept playing the piano all her life, really, till towards the end.
So was there acting in that as well, Jeff?
She was very... You're trying to build up something about me now, aren't you?
No, not at all. I'm thinking about your mother.
Yes, no, she was in... She was an actress. It was all sort of top-level society and the sort of things you did. It was not for earning anything and so on. But that we do know about J.C. Williamson and her playing in some of those theatre plays. At her silver wedding.
Yes, keep going.
At her silver wedding, she they were able to get her to recite, and my father just loved all of that. He'd loved that. But on the other hand, to be very frank, he was a pretty jealous sort of person in regard to my mother. If anybody even looked at her, even when she was old, you know, and what we call old, and perhaps looking at like that, and any young man came around, he's very suspicious, which was a big joke in the family. but I know he had to face her father, who didn't seem to have all that much appreciation of him. I guess he appreciated the fact that he had a profession, and my father was a very astute man, because I think he was astute in every possible way. He seemed a man who could do anything. He was more a Puritan type person, on for self-righteousness and those sort of things. My mother was a very, very godly woman, but she was very mystical about her faith. And when I was a boy of 15, it seems strange to say now, but I taught her the basic things of what one would call the gospel, and her whole understanding blazed out. And later in life, when my father died, he wouldn't let her go to church, but later when she did go to church and she shared in some Bible studies, she knew far more than any of the ministers knew. She could she knew what the references were. Quite an incredible person, and she had a lot to do with my moral upbringing, and she was very emphatic about those things. But I have a photo of her as a girl of 17 when she first met my father, and she has masses of jewellery she's wearing. She took all my mother's jewellery one day and put it all on, and that's how my father met her. And a lot of wonderfully humorous things that happened with her. So I imagine there are stories that were not told, because she was a very vivacious person, and I would imagine was very attractive to young fellas and so on.
And just, I'm sorry we have to do this, but just going back again, your grandfather, Jerome Dowling, was a very well-known person in Sydney.
Yes, he was.
Who'd been president of the Tattersalls Club and had a rich Irish background.
That's very much so.
And he'd married your grandmother, who was a very, came from a very learned Irish family, as I understand it.
Yes, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Jerome Dowling, how he struck you.
Well, the thing that for years I remembered him most was when we would see him, which would be not very often, but he always gave us a gold sovereign each. Each one of the family would give us a gold sovereign. Don't you tell anybody, he'd say. But what could you do if you had a golden sovereign? Because they were worth a lot of money in those days. Yes, he was a generous man. He smoked Havana cigars. I can always remember that he had a white moustache at the age when I remember him, and it was tinged, you know, with tobacco, with the nicotine, and he loved drink. I'm trying to think what drink it was he loved, but anyway,
probably whiskey.
Whiskey, that's it. Whiskey, it was whiskey, and then he was a very astute man too in the world of business, and as I say, at one stage he was president of Tattersall's Club, which was looked upon as, you know, socially quite something to be and to do. And he had these sons, which he had, and daughters. They were all very. They were my mother's sister, Minnie. She was a very vivacious woman too, like her, like my mother, whose name was Eileen Minnie, and this other one was Minnie something. And then there were the sons. There were three sons. There were more than three sons. I think there were four sons, and we knew the youngest one most because he was more towards our own age. But the three of the men went to war, and they came back. And I know one of them was a bad alcoholic. And then he eventually went to Scotland and met her other beautiful woman and married her. But then nobody thought he'd ever marry, and she actually cleared him of his alcoholism and made him a good Christian man in the best sense of that word. And then the oldest brother, my father, grandfather, bought a beautiful place in Queensland, and a very, very big property, cattle and sheep property, and that was to be for the boys altogether. And I know when my grandfather died, they actually came to some terms about it, but his oldest son retained the property.
So this beautiful pastoral property, Jeff, was retained by the oldest son.
Yes, and
No, that's okay. I'll ask you another question. Yeah. Well, you've spoken a bit about the remarkable family on your mother's side.
Yeah.
But your father too had a remarkable family. His sister, for instance, Florence. Is that right?
No, she was my mother's.
Oh, sister. Sure. Your mother's sister was Florence.
Yes, Florence.
She was a remarkable person.
Yes. Well, she's very well known. I was in the local church one day, and there's a man well over 7 feet. A regular worshipper, and I knew he came from Ceduna area. He was a pastoralist, and I said, "Did you know my aunt, Aunt Florence Dowling?" He said, "Do I know her?" He said, "My wife was brought into the world by her," and things like that. But yes, there's sort of great myths and legends grow up about her. Very forceful woman, and very godly woman, and sought to make as many possible godly also. But there's a street in Ceduna named after her, Dowling Street. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, we spoke earlier about your siblings too, your brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And in your book, My Beloved Family, you really describe them beautifully. Your sisters were obviously very beautiful women.
They were.
And your brothers, great characters, as I understand
it. Yes. Our father actually used to get us, when we were at Warunga, he would have us out the back lawn behind the house, and we would all have to fight each other, you know, to box each other. Yes, and all of us. And wouldn't let us off. And my eldest brother was a very gentle sort of fellow, very competent and astute, but that's one thing he didn't like. And when he was a boy, one of his brothers went for him one day, and he said, "Oh, you wouldn't hurt Horry, would you?" That was his name, was Horace, which he hated, and we all used to have to call him Ray outside the home. Yes. Did I mention the fact that he eventually was given the MBE?
No, you didn't.
No, he was given the MBE, and he was always, that was for undercover work, you know, cloak and dagger, and he was made vice consul of Mozambique, yes, I think, to aid him in his, what he was doing, because with the trouble, my brother was always there when the thing happened in Egypt over the canal. My brother was there,
the Suez crisis.
Yes, he was right in the centre of that, obviously quite harmless with the way he played the game. And then when we had problems in the Arab Emirates, he was at that time general manager of BOAC, BOAC Middle East. So yes, he's a very colourful person, a very good writer. He wrote stories, and he had my mother's histrionic abilities. I can still remember him. He had organised a concert, and I can see him rushing backwards and forwards with his arms raised and shouting. but as a sort of a reaction to him, as by the brother below him, because we used to call my brother Lord somebody, I've forgotten what the name was, and he had a plum in his mouth, you know, for when he was born, and it was very unreal to us as Aussie kids, you know. Then my brother Francis, he went in for window dressing, which was not, if you lived on the North Shore, you didn't do window dressing, you know. It was a pity for the reputation of the family, but he apparently was very, very good at it. And then my brother Reg, he was a Dubuque grad, but he was an orchardist down the south coast of New South Wales, and at one stage he was the president of the Maroolan Shire, I think it was, or mm-hmm. Goulburn Shire. And then there was, and as I say, he was also in the Pacific, in the army. He was in the original 6th Division, where he went off to the Middle East on the Queen Mary, the first time that was used for transporting troops. And it just happened that later on, when we went to Malaya, we went on the Queen Mary too. Yes, there wasn't a souvenir left. But our wily fellows saw possibilities. There were electric clocks above the lifts, you know, watching the lifts coming. So they, all the hands of those went, and the numbers and so on. But anyway, just sort of my brother Edge, and he was a very attractive sort of person. I had to bury him 3 years ago when he had an accident. He actually had a heart attack coming onto one of the main highways and was killed. Then my brother below him was a ground engineer. He and I, we worked a farm for our father at, I should say. Very much under my father's direction. He'd always wanted to be a sort of country squire, so he always wore special riding gear, jodhpurs and whatever. But he really did like that work, and we did too. And then my brother did the main amount of work on that property, and then he went into became a ground engineer with Qantas in New Guinea during the war. So my sister Norma, she was second sister Gloria, just below me in years, and then Norma, and she was in the
WAF?
WAFs, yeah. Yeah, no, WAFs are Air Force, aren't they?
Oh, sorry, yes, the the army equivalent. Yeah.
Wand or something.
Wand, yeah.
Forgotten what they were. But at any rate, she was very competent in that. And I was trying to tell her that how her father was a very Puritan man. He never went near the church, although later in life when I was preaching, he would come, which was very wonderful for us. But those three girls, Gloria and Norma and Valda was what my father used to call an Australian beauty. She had naturally golden hair, but dark eyebrows. Was quite a combination, and was known in those days as an Australian beauty. My father would never allow them to go out at night, and certainly never allow them to go out on their own. But they were very good horsewomen, the three of them. And so the Richmond Air Base was about 8 or 9 miles from us, and they went to they used to go up there and prearrange a meeting place closer to our place than to Richmond, but they would meet. And one night they came home, and with their horses dray down below and on the flats, and they looked up and they saw my father standing there, and they were horrified at what was going to happen to them. So they stayed there all night, and early in the morning they made their way up to discover it was an old harvester that had been ruined. It was just the remains of it, and it wasn't my father at all. And so there were things like that happened to regale the family. Yes, they were the most interesting things.
Yeah.
And of course different places we've been, particularly the Box Hill, which was the original Terry's home, all built in cedar and sandstock brick and sandstone. Beautiful, beautiful place.
I wonder, before we deal with that, Jeff, if we just come back for a minute. Your earliest memories were at Goulburn as a baby, and you talked about looking up and seeing the beautiful Australian bush.
Oberon was the place we used to go into the forest. Mm. And later I got to know Australia to do with bush, but there's a difference between bush and forest. Mm. And these, well, to me, of course, as a baby, these are not.
That's all right.
Want to go there?
No, that's fine.
As to me, as a baby, they were, the trees were, reached into the sky. They were very, very beautiful. That lovely, calm, peaceful quietness. It's still with me, that. That was very, very beautiful. And we lived in a place called the Lilacs, and of course it had lovely lilac trees. And in Goulburn, my father was first practicing in Sydney, and then he went to Armidale, and then to Goulburn, and then back to Sydney. He retired from his dentistry at Goulburn. Meanwhile, the children were still coming. I think I was about 5 when we came to Sydney, and that would be, and then there were children born after that. And
you moved to a house that they built at Warunga?
My father built it.
Mm-hmm.
The contractor and the men built it, but in fact my father must have been a pest to the, he was always there, everything. I can remember he took me across one day by train from Ashfield to Warunga, and I can remember my father didn't seem to have all that much interest in me, at least that appeared to me at the time. But he took me this day, and it was a great event in my life. But I can always remember he let me go down below the floor, which the joists were there, but the floorboards weren't put on at that time, and let me go down and pick up the nails. And this was a big thing in my life. I could remember picking up the nails, and remember the travelling in the train, because there were steam trains, and it was a different world. And our Pacific Highway, we were on the Pacific Highway, and it was just like two lanes, like really, like what we call one lane road, and I can remember the horses used to milk carts, the vegetable carts, the baker's carts, and the props carts, the show, yelling out for clothes props, and all of those things. So it was a great place if you want to get some horse manure to go out on the road, and it was pretty squashed out and dried up by then, and so on. But that was the kind of world we lived in. And
Jeff, you said too that it was a very beautiful place.
Oh, yeah.
Your father loved gardening and encouraged you in that.
That's right. Yes, he set us all to have gardens. We had quite a large property, and then later, the place next to us was burned down, and he bought that property. He'd run out of opportunities for landscaping, so he just bought that house and built a croquet court, if you please, that was a very interesting a change in our lives, ladies and, you know, older folk coming in and playing croquet. But what I really loved was the fact that we were just 5 minutes from the bush, and that was real bush. That was tall trees, and then glades. You'd come to a glade of Christmas bells, unbelievable, beautiful, and flannel flowers and such things. And I have a story called that talks about jewel beetles. I went to one place and there were just thousands of these of all different colours. So unbelievably beautiful. And of course, by that time, as at an agricultural high school, we had to have insect collections, and so we used to have swaps of insects, and I had a time that I could still smell the special tea tree, and with all these beautiful, in the sunlight, with all these beautiful beetles crawling over the flowers and things like that. And you know, we'd have the trees were filled with Sydney waxbills and other finches at the time, particularly you could see firetails and a whole host of lovely birds, and so I would go out into the bush every morning. I wouldn't have any shoes on. I'd dash off, and it was so beautiful. And then there was on the way there was a dairy farm for the Havilah homes for orphan children, and I just loved that, and I wagged it from Sunday school on, which was like a super crime to do that one Sunday afternoon, because I saw a cow calving, and I didn't know cows calved. I didn't know anything about I knew a lot about the birds and the bees, but not about their antics, and so I was stunned by this. And but I had a great laugh, you know, where you could come across these great big crayfish in the creeks and all sorts of things in those days that you don't find and see. Butterflies of large dimensions and all of that. Marvellous, really. But our place, I was Abbotsley Girls College was opposite us, and the girls used to call me the boy at the place of roses or something, but we had literally hundreds of rose trees and rose climbers, and yes, our place was very, very beautiful.
Jeff, was the church central to your life from those early days?
Yes it was. My father made sure we all went to church. You were never allowed to do otherwise, and to Sunday school. But I had a problem. My big problem was, and it's been the problem right through my life, really. It's what you call a sanctuary, a place that is holy. We'd go there on Sunday, and it smelled the mustiness of being locked up all the week. And I had this picture of God being locked up all the week, waiting for Sunday, when he had his due in worship services, and then this beautiful world. I've always loved the creation, always delighted in living in it. That afternoon, I had this big battle, because the bell was rung a quarter hour before Sunday school, and that meant everybody in the district would come. And then at 3 o'clock, that was the bell that you went in to. And here was I out on this dairy farm, this cow being calving, and the wonder would just grip me. And I thought, the God who does all this, he seems so different to the one who is in the building. And so I was trying to knit together two gods, one who was the God of creation and the other one who was the God of religion, and they didn't seem to knit together very well. So I had that was a great problem with me. But eventually, when these meshed, or I saw they were aspect or properties or characteristics of the same God, that just was a tremendous revelation to me.
Jeff, you always had a certainty of God from a very early age.
Yes, when I was 5 years of age, I was told, my mother was told many years afterwards, that by the woman who's my teacher, Mrs. Parr, that I had said, I got up in the class one day and said, well, God has called me to be a preacher. And that was that. And years later, I was trained also, I think it was in the primary school by her son, who was a very tall man and to me looked evil. Probably was just a really nice fellow, but he taught me too. But yeah, well, there are other things. I had problems at schools. I really did have problems. I could never just accept what was taught. You had to learn things by rote and so on. And that was good, but I always wanted to know why this thing was as it was. And while I was thinking about that, the class was going on and learning, and so I didn't do very well in certain subjects like maths and science and so on.
How about literature, though, at school?
When I was 12, about 12 and a half, I had a very deep spiritual experience at that time, and what I would say, I came to understand God's love in Christ and through his incarnation and his works and the cross and so on. And we had a teacher, and his name was Smith, but everybody called him Anzac Smith, because he'd been in the war, he'd been an Anzac, and we knew that if we wanted to have a break in heavy teaching, that provided we could get him onto something about Anzac, that we'd have the rest of the period would be beautiful, admirable. So he said to me one day, Bingham, I want you to write a poem. It was Tuesday, and bring it in on Thursday, said the class. I said, oh, I've never written a poem, sir, because that was considered very effeminate to write poetry. Sissy. And anyway, I wrote this poem and I rather enjoyed it. It was called Ode to a Daisy. And so when I gave it to him, he didn't say anything about it. And then he said, now, if you've done this, I want you to write a short story. And I said, well, sir, I have never written a short story. No, he said, but bring it in on next Tuesday. So I did, and found I enjoyed it. And then he said, now by Thursday I want you to do this scene of Henry V. You know, once more to the breach, dear friends, once more I'll hold up the wall with our English dead. In peace there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness or humility. But when the sound of war sounds in his ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favoured rage, and then let the ire, terrible aspect, let it pry through the portage of the head like a brass cannon, let the brow overwhelm it as fearfully doth the galled rock, or hang and jutty its confounded base, as swilled by the wild and wasteful ocean. On you, English, whose blood is fed from fathers of war-proof, fathers who, like so many Alexanders, have from mournful even fought and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. So that's what I learned, and anyway, that began, that started me off. That was when I began to, I knew that I'd be a writer, and I always had a sense of conflict that I was to be a writer and I was to be a preacher, and I didn't see those two could meet. But I remember going into town, saving up money from carting barrel loads of manure for my mother's garden, and
this is off the road, is it?
Yeah, it's off the road, and then also I took some from the farm, but that was very wet. That was cow manure. The other was generally horse manure. And then the bottler used to come around, and beer bottles, any bottles, you could make money from those. So I had enough money. I had £2, and I went into town and I bought a typewriter for £2. Typewriters were certainly very, very expensive, but it was a vintage type, you know, it belonged to the museum. But then I didn't have anywhere to be able to write, because with 9 children, we were fairly, you know, provided for, but not to have a study for a little boy. And so I went into the laundry and used to have the scrubbing board, which I put over the tubs. Mm. And then I put my typewriter on top of that, and I had a couple of boxes that bring me up high enough, and so that's where I started to write when I was about 13 years of age. And
so yeah. What school had you been going to at Warunga, Jeff?
I went to Warrawee. Warrawee kindergarten, and then to the primary school. And then I used to go out from Warunga to a place called Glenfield, which is past Liverpool, and it used to take us a long time. I'd have to get up very, very early in the morning, and then I'd get home very late at night. I wanted to be a farmer. And that was the third element in the conflict. How could you be a farmer and a writer and a preacher?
So this was out to health and
agriculture high school, yes. Well, it was more than high school. It was like a college, because they had a big hostel for the students who came from the country. And, of course, it was only for males at that time. And it was a great rugger school, yeah, very special players there, and it is still a wonderful place because it had tons of land. Like here in South Australia, Herbra is a very fine school, but it wasn't a patch on this this school. It had great had loads of Clydesdales and Shire draft horses, and a great herd of Ayrshire cows, and sheep, and a big piggery, and all of that, and I just revelled in that.
So they basically teach you how to handle all livestock, do you?
Everything from go to woe, yes.
And the soil?
Yes, the soil. Oh, an enormous vegetable garden, and then there were great acres for growing cereals, and particularly corn, and we had big orchard, and yes, it was a great place.
Did that satisfy some of those desires?
Oh yes, it did. I loved it being there, but I did very well in all the subjects except French. And in those days, if you're going to matriculate, you had to have both Latin and French, so it wasn't just all horticulture and agricultural, but I had to repeat my second year because I wasn't good at French, so I had fixed in my mind that I was not very good at languages. But in fact, I later found I had an aptitude for languages. I remember most of my French, which is a strange thing. I can virtually read a book in French today, but of course later on I had to learn Greek, and I had this overhang when I went to theological college of not being able to do languages. So I was frustrated, and then I joined the army, not exactly to get away from Greek, but partly.
Jeff, when you were at Hurlston, yes, were you travelling there daily by train?
Yes, daily by train.
Daily?
Yes. I've forgotten how long it was. A couple of hours.
Yeah, it must have been.
Yes, and we'd go to Hornsby,
yeah,
and then we'd go down to Strathfield,
yeah,
and then we'd change at Strathfield and get a train out to, you'd go either via Lidcombe or via Sefton Park, I think. There were two lines out. And then at Liverpool you had to get... they did have a sort of a motor train, you know, just a single thing, but you generally had to get a steam train. But the electric trains were just coming in at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, at that time you may have to. Yes, you'd have to go some of the journey away by steam train.
Now, in those years of your high school when you were learning at Hurlston,
yeah,
was there also this longing in your life to continue to grow as a preacher, if you like?
Oh, yes. Well, back, like in the weekends, we had a boys' club at the church, and by this time I had reconciled myself to the church, to going to the church, and I was also just coming to that stage where you notice that boys and girls were different, you know, and it was quite interesting to go to church. I mean, everybody goes through that stage, and I certainly did.
This was an Anglican church.
Oh yes, yes, very evangelical. You weren't even allowed to have flowers on the above the holy table, because we looked on as pagan, and you never had a cross in the church because that was very, very highly Anglo-Catholic and so on. But they were wonderful years, they really were, and I could, whereas in those days I used to sometimes react, say, to the choir and different people, but I've always been fascinated by people. That's been my total primary fascination, is people, and I don't see how you could be a writer if it were. The boys' club, I eventually led the boys' club, and every one of those boys came into that experience of Christ. It was very remarkable, really. And only about 10 years ago, I got a letter from and a little packet from one of the former members of the boys' club, and he sent me two magazines. I used to edit a magazine when I was about 16, it's very interesting. Every boy in that club enlisted. Is it quite a while that I don't know, but it was just interesting. It's not even trivia. It's very important, I think. But nevertheless, that was it.
Jeff, you mentioned earlier that your father very much encouraged you to go to church, well, more than that, insisted on you going,
yes,
to church. How did he react to your wanting to go into the ministry?
He reacted very strongly against it. Totally, utterly, totally. A strange thing, and I was only thinking about it yesterday, I was in the garden, and when you used to have knickerbockers, you know, which of course you don't see today at all, but that was when you were having a transition from being a boy to becoming an adolescent, really. And anyway, I used to be in knickerbockers when I go to Sunday school, and one day I was expelled from Sunday school because of my cheekiness, and I was a bit of a ratbag, you know, looking back at that. But this superintendent, who was unbelievably a superintendent of a Sunday school, just said, "That boy will never enter the Sunday school again." And I said, "Oh yes, I will if I want to." "No," he said, "you are expelled forever." So I went home, and Dad said, "You're home early today?" And I said, "Yes, Dad, I've left Sunday school." He said, "You've what?" I said, "I've left Sunday school." "What do you mean?" "Oh, Dad," he said, "he says, I'm going into long pants next week. You told me that. So, I'm Sunday school past now." "Oh, it is, is it?" he said. He said, "As far as I'm concerned, it's not. What did you do?" And I told him. He said, "Right, next week you go back and you apologise to Mr. Jones and you tell him you're sorry and ask his permission for you to go on in the Sunday school, and that your father sent you to do that," so, which I did, of course. But it shocked me that my father, who was so anti-religious, although he always insisted on us going to Sunday school and church, should make me go back there. And you know, that did something in my life. If my father had said, "Well, that's okay," I would have had an attitude, at least I assume I would have had an attitude, that those things didn't matter. But when he said it, I knew they mattered. And the essence of what law is kind of entered into my soul. Very significant happening in my life. And I thought, well, my father, somehow or another, he's on God's side. He's not what he makes himself out to be. And in his older age, we were very close. And very, very close. And he came into an experience of Christ. And that's a story all in its own.
Well, Jeff, what then led your father to eventually pack up with your mother and leave this beautiful place at Warunga,
yeah,
and to purchase Box Hill, the Terry's Rouse family, yeah, property near Richmond? What would, yeah, ever have led him to do that?
Well, apparently all his life he had wanted to be a farmer. And that wasn't the way life turned out, with being a dentist. But when he retired at Goulburn, he had really made a lot of money, and that was a fact. And he had something like what we would call a nervous breakdown. But my father was what I understood as a moody man. He'd go into moods, and then there would be that darkness across the family at that period of time, and so on. But he wanted to have a farm, and the beautiful place we had at Warunga, he landscaped the whole of it. He built all the concrete paths, and there were plenty of them. He built fountains. He built a garage. There weren't many garages in those days. And he had this marvellous place, but he ran out of work. There was nothing else he could do. See, when that house was burned down next to us, he grabbed it, and we thought, if another place burns down, he'll get that too, because he wants to landscape. It's his love. And he was excellent at it. But he was the kind of man who could not stop working. He would have what we call the Calvinistic ethic of work. That's the reason that he wanted to go and to have this farm. And yes,
but he obviously expected you to work also, and your brothers.
Yes, well, and my other brother. But the other brothers, like my brother beyond Stan, the one above me, he was already doing orchard work down in Talon in South Coast, New South Wales. And then my other brother was, of course, in his window dressing, and the other one was he went to England when he was very young. He went as a steward on board a ship. He actually got his pilot's license, but he did sort of steward work. But then he joined the OAC. I forgot what it was called in his days, but in the early days.
BEA.
BEA, was
British Empire Airways.
Was that the first one?
Oh, well,
I don't know. I'm not sure. They had, but BIC, we always called Bet on a Camel. BIC never arrived on time or went on time. But no, so that was, yes. Yes, so my father was, when we went to the Terry's old place, and it made him. He just loved that. That was, and again, you see, we built all our styes for the pigs. We built a new set of dairy, you know, the bales and greenhouse and all of these things, cooler, and we put in innumerable fences. I could build a fence with my eyes closed, you know, today. And amazing things, really. But of course, it was a beautiful old home, and the convicts used to live below the house because they had these big grates, gratings, you may call them, and they were locked under those at night. But a fire took place just before, a few years before we bought the property, and they closed the old cellars down beneath them. But it was a lovely place, and it was like all the architraves and the skirtings, which were a foot high, and the doors were all red cedar. Beautiful. The place was a wonderful, great room. It used to be the ballroom. It's a very lovely place, yeah. And he loved all of that.
And Jeff, how did you find it there? You'd been to agricultural high school, or you were going there.
No, I'd gone.
How did you find it there? Obviously, your father wanted you to be there.
Yes, well, I loved the property. I loved the farming. I just loved it. But still, I was separated from the folk who had sort of spiritual affinity in Wirunga, and all along that North Shore line. It was a kind of a whole community of us, and I loved that. So I started to do my matriculation, because I only went to third year in high school, I joined up with a correspondence school, CCS, I remember school something, and I started to do Latin. And other subjects, and actually it came out of the fact that we were always up at 5 o'clock in the morning, no later, and we worked until sunset, and I would have to put the cows in the night paddock and do all kinds of things, so there really wasn't time for us to be awake at night. But my brother and I, we had a generator which generated all our electricity. Mm-hmm. It was a very powerful one, but my father turned it off at a certain time, so that was just to do with economics. But so we bought a little electric set, you know, where we could have, so we'd read at night in bed, so I'd do my study, and sometimes I'd get up early in the morning and do it, and my father knew nothing about those things. And
were you still writing in those years as well with your old typewriter?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was. Mm. Yes. And just trying to think. I think by that time I had a portable. Yes, I used to do a lot of writing. And then Sundays were our days off. We just had to do the milking, of course, and feed the pigs and so on. But after that, we were off. And our father used to work around the house. He didn't take Sunday off, so we would feel guilty that we weren't working too, and consequences. But anyway, he discovered that I was studying for this, and he was very, very angry. And he said, I bought this property for you and your brother. And he said, this is going to be yours and the girls. The three young ones were at home. So there was quite a dust up, and as a result, I left home.
Where did you head for, Jeff?
Well, I headed for Warunga, Normanhurst, which is the next suburb of south, and that's where my girlfriend, as I understood, was a girlfriend, lived too. But there was an old digger, and his name was Lewis, and I've forgotten his Christian name, but they always call him Digger anyway, and he was an old Anzac, and he had a sad, he had been gassed, particularly with mustard gas, and his lungs were gone, and he was a wonderful man, but they were very poor, the family were very poor, but they took me in and helped me, and I had a little bit of a bank account that I go by, and then...
How did you know them, Jeff? Was that through the church?
That was through our boys' club.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and we had a wonderful club. That could be a story all in the same, if one could resurrect it, but the one of the boys was a member of the Wynn family, and the Wynns had five friendly stores. They were like departmental stores in different places, and one in Oxford Street, and I had worked there while my father was still looking for property. I'd worked there in that store, the son had come to know Christ through my ministry, and then his whole family, and some of them were deaf, but one of them was the general manager of the Oxford Street store. But these, we just had the habit after church, I was going to walk with Stan that night, his home was in Warunga on the other side of the line, which was the more highly social area, and I'd walk across with him to his home, and then he'd walk back to mine. We talked over these things, which were so wonderful to us. And so I stayed with the Lewises for a while, and then I knew I had to get some money before I went into college. I applied for college and was accepted.
Oh, was this theological college?
All theological college, yes. I was accepted, but I went up into the country to a place called Dungog. And do you remember reading a story about a young man who was working there, 10 shillings a week in your keep?
Yes.
And there's some very interesting stories, which I won't...
Was that the occasion, Jeff, in which the farmer was trying to take advantage of as a workman on this dairy farm?
Yeah, yeah.
And you held on to the tail of his prize bull for a bit long and stripped the skin off?
What do you call it when you with a tree?
Ringbarker.
I ringbarked. I was very, very strong, very physically strong, superb, he asked me on the Sunday to help. Look, he said, I know Sunday's your day. I mean, I milked morning and evening, but he said we've got they're growing up, and all these calves and young bulls and heifers, he said, they're not being branded, and could you give me a hand? I was just so furious that if there was any spirituality in me, it went out in one go. And so we branded, and I was very strong, and I would throw. There are two ways you did it, you know. One got hold of the tail, one got the horns, and you twisted around, and down they went, and then you put a knee in, and so on. But I could see this young bull was about 18 months old, and it was an Ayrshire, and they're pretty wild stock. And he kept on looking. He was very cunning. He kept out of our way. And then last week, he was the last one, and we left. So it took us a long time to get him. And I got him by the horns. He got him by the horns, and I had him by the tail. And we went to throw him, as was agreed. He was very chicken. He really was. He was afraid of his stock, and he let go of the horns, and this thing, up and reared up and went like that. And I was so furious. It would take an hour to get him. And he would never get a hold of him after that. So I just hung on for that tail. Now I said, "Grab his horns!" And he looked like an idiot, you know. And this thing was bucking and making those noises, and then something went, something gave, and it was that I'd actually hung onto his, onto it, so that the skin and the hair were just parted, and there was this tail ring marked for about, I would say about 18 inches. I mean, I gave it up by the time it started to ring bark. If I left, the damage was done. And after that, he never dreamed. He used to sort of kowtow to me. And so, yes, anyway, that was that before I went into more college. Yes.